My guest today, Garth Porter, is an independent investigative journalist and historian specializing in U.S. national security policy and institutions and winner of the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism in 2011. He's a regular contributor to Interpress News Service since 2004, and his articles appeared in The Nation, Salon, and Truth Out. He's the author of Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power on the Road to War in Vietnam, which was once his specialty, and his latest Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he has been a frequent guest on this program. Welcome once again, Garth Porter, to Takes on the World.
Thanks so much for having me back, Jeff.
It would seem, viewing events in Gaza, Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, and elsewhere in the world, that the only piece of good news we've had these days is that the P5 nations and plus one and Iran have amicably agreed to extend the negotiations on Iran's nuclear energy program. And from what you have been writing, this comes as no surprise.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. Certainly, in the last several weeks, I've seen indications that the two sides were not going to have to break up the talks in failure. And the reason was becoming increasingly clear. That is that there was the basis for an agreement that would certainly meet the minimum requirements, the basic interests of both sides. And I think that fact is unfortunately one that has somehow escaped the mainstream media coverage of this issue. We've simply gotten a very different picture for the last few months of these negotiations, both in prospect and during the negotiations, and then when they were finished.
Well, certainly the articles that you posted on Interpress News Service do show a different story, a much more complex one than what we were hearing. One thing that's interesting, I received in the email today an email from the National Iranian American Council, which pushes friendly relations between the U.S. and Iran, and they list the organizations and politicians and who are for and against the talks extension. And it's interesting that there's a picture of Dianne Feinstein, or as I mentioned, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who made a very important speech last year, I believe it was earlier this year, opposing further sanctions on Iran, saying that in a sense that they might lead to another war. And Feinstein, who is in an impregnable position as a U.S. senator financially and has a reputation that is relatively untarnished, I thought at that time that speech was one of the most important speeches ever made by a senator, and it seemed to give other Democrats in the Senate some backbone to resist the pressure of the Israel lobby and the neocon think tanks to resist the new sanctions that seemed almost inevitable at that time. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, I think that's right, and I remember that speech. We may have even discussed it.
We probably did.
which I was here on your program. But yes, the importance of that is indeed that that Feinstein and some other Democratic senators began to become more serious about opposing the position of the Israeli lobby on the negotiations, and particularly on the idea that you know, we should take such a hard line that the negotiations cannot succeed, which is, of course, what Israel has wanted all along, because the cost of that, the risk of that, is simply too high. And I think that position that Feinstein was laying out, and which is shared by some other key Democratic senators, is indeed a reflection of the limits of how far the Israeli lobby, how far AIPAC, can really go in terms of pushing Congress on the Iran issue. And I think that limit is precisely where it is possible to make a very cogent and serious argument that the risk of collapsing the talks, the risk of the extreme position, which would have the implication that the talks should fail, is simply that the United States would be risking war with Iran. And I think that is a bridge too far for AIPAC and for the Israeli lobby.
Now, I mentioned, we discussed it earlier, too, how the Senate has already passed resolutions unanimously in the past that would support Israel should decide to attack Iran in quote-unquote self-defense before the Feinstein speech and before the setback for the AIPAC movement. It seemed that these sanctions, new sanctions, were a sure thing. And now it seems that their fallback position is that whatever agreement is reached between Iran and the P5 plus one nations, that the U.S. Congress must be able to ratify that. Is there something in U.S. law that would require that, or is this just a ploy, a final kind of a hold-the-line measure on the part of AIPAC and the Washington Sufrenirist policy and the Foreign Policy Initiative and so on? Is that
well? This agreement is uniquely one that is clearly subject to congressional ratification in the political sense, not in a legal sense, but in a political sense, because of the centrality, of course, of the sanctions being lifted as part of the agreement. I mean, without a commitment by Congress to support the lifting of sanctions, this agreement simply cannot work. And so there is effectively a kind of veto power that Congress has over this if they choose to wield that power. I mean, and the question which we've just, I think, gotten to at the very beginning of this interview, of whether the pro-Israeli contingent in Congress can overcome this political problem that the taking the position that essentially is equivalent to the collapse of the talks or of undermining and neutralizing the agreement if and when, and I think it will be reached, that is the equivalent of committing the United States to a military confrontation with Iran. I think that is the main deterrent to the pro-Israeli contingent going for either new sanctions that would effectively undermine the agreement, or simply doing something that nullifies the agreement more directly. And so I think that is there's a kind of a balance of power, if you will, that now exists. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to play out, but it's not clear that that Congress can simply override this straightforwardly. I think there will be efforts to do that, but it is going to be contested, and it's going to be an interesting process, that's for sure.
Well, the U.S. has such power because of the power of U.S. banks and the need for foreign banks to use the U.S. banking system puts the United States in a unique position. We've seen the fines it has levied on French banks and Swiss banks, as if the United States is the great international ruler of fair banking, which is kind of a joke. But this ability to implement sanctions, and essentially the U.S. is not only sanctioning Iran, but is sanctioning any country or company that would do business with Iran. It does put Congress in a tremendous driver's seat on this, because there would have to be legislation, I presume, which would withdraw those sanctions that are currently in place. That's what you're saying.
Well, that's right, and you're absolutely correct that the U.S. ability to threaten foreign banks with retaliation by taking away their ability, their authority to do business with the U.S. Financial system is the most powerful tool the United States has at this point for carrying out its policy of sanctions against Iran. And that indeed has replaced the military option as the ultimate sanction of the United States. I think the military option clearly is no longer credible to the Iranians, no longer credible to much of anybody in the Middle East. And I think that it has effectively ceased to be, a major instrument of U.S. Policy in that part of the world. And I think what has replaced it is precisely the sanctions system. And at the heart of that sanction system is precisely this ability to punish foreign banks for doing business with Iran. And I think that has undoubtedly generated a lot of intimidation within the banking systems around the world, and no doubt a lot of hostility, a lot of bad feeling toward the United States as well because of the way it's been wielded.
Now, we hear repeatedly that that there's kind of a balance between the two sides, that we have the American hardliners here. They don't describe them as necessarily being pro-Israel hardliners. They describe the hardliners as being anti-Iranian hardliners in the United States against the deal, as opposed to hardliners in Iran who are opposed to a deal. How do you respond? What's your take? How would you describe this comparison, and how realistic is it?
Well, I think it is true that there is certainly this kind of, you can call it a balance or a symmetry, if you will, between the way in which the Israel-oriented and I would say Israeli-controlled contingent in Congress, which of course virtually extends to almost everybody in the Senate, in the sense that the Israelis were able to manipulate a 100-0 vote to endorse the Israeli position on the Gaza attack. And I think it's an astonishing illustration of the power of the Israeli lobby over the Senate, and one that I tweeted about, saying that this should make it clear to everybody that the U.S. Congress has has been taken over by a foreign power. On the other side, of course, you have the reality that public opinion is very strongly committed to Iran's nuclear rights, meaning the right to enrich, meaning the ability to have a civil nuclear program free of interference by the nuclear powers of the world, that is the P5, the five nuclear powers who make up the P5 plus one, meaning Germany. So that is the political force on the other side. Now, there is a sort of, some people would call it extremist nationalist faction in Iranian politics, in the Majlis, that is the Iranian parliament, which, voices strong criticism of the positions taken by the Iranian nuclear negotiators in sort of similar fashion to the pro-Israeli right in Congress, in the Senate in particular. So there's that degree of symmetry. But I think behind that, on the Iranian side, you do have a very powerful majority opinion that would really not stand for an Iranian negotiating posture that gave up too much of Iran's capability for enriching uranium. I think that there's a certain symbolism involved in this issue for the Iranian side. That is, if Iran were to have accepted the demand of the P5 plus one to reduce the number of centrifuges that are now in place by, let's say, 80%, that would be regarded as bowing to the pressure of the United States and its allies, and that would not be popular at all. I think that it would be very difficult for any Iranian government to be able to go into an election with that on its in its background, and I think that it would stand to lose an election because of that. So I think that's a big part of the politics on the Iranian side, not just the existence of a political faction, a set of political forces, well-heeled, supported by the IRGC, or at least some elements of the IRGC, which have a lot of money, and so forth. That would be the closest equivalent to the Israeli lobby on the U.S. side. But I think behind that, there's a much more powerful a public opinion that also has to be taken into account by the Iranian negotiators.
Well, actually, when you consider that Israel has nuclear weapons, which no United States government official will dare mention, even if asked a question, direct question about it, it's obviously that pushing a country like Iran with a long, long history is an insult to their dignity, and that should be well understood.
I think it is. I think it is understood, at least at some level, by people in the Obama administration. Yes.
Now it's interesting the role being played by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. You wrote about that back on the 12th for Interpress Service.
Yes.
And his remarks that he showed both sides, how both sides maneuver on how much nuclear energy can be enriched. Of course, within the United States, the critics of demand and Israel demands no enrichment, which is, of course, the United States can't take that policy. But describe your take on Khamenei and the role he's been playing.
Yes. But let me just take
yes.
a step back from
yes, sure.
the Khamenei speech of July 7th, because I think that speech is an illustration of the broader situation that we have seen playing out in these negotiations, which is that you've had a steady drumbeat of public, I would call it posturing. I think it's quite accurate to call it posturing politically by the Obama administration over the past few months, beginning really in April, which has been along the lines that Iran is going to have to agree, is going to have to settle for a huge cut in its centrifuge numbers. And short of that, there can't be any agreement, because otherwise the timeline for breakout, they call it the breakout timeline, cannot be lengthened to 6 to 12 months, which is the minimum that Secretary John Kerry laid out in April to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as the absolute minimum requirement for the United States to be assured that the Iranian program is for peaceful purposes and not for nuclear weapons. And so that has been the background noise, if you will, that has been repeated a number of times over the last few months on the American side. And within the talks themselves, we now know from Khamenei's July 7th speech, in fact, that in the June round of negotiations, the United States was taking the position, and it was in the actual draft of the agreement, in brackets, the bracketed draft, that the P5 plus one was demanding roughly 1,000 or even 500. There were two alternatives in brackets in the in that draft, according to Khamenei, and I have reason to believe that that is absolutely correct. The posturing that was made publicly by the Obama administration was actually being reflected in the draft itself by this extreme demand for extreme cut in the Iranian in the number of Iranian centrifuges. Now, it's very clear to me that the Obama administration knew perfectly well was not going to succeed in getting Iran to agree to that. that was going along with the public posturing as a means of putting pressure on Iran. And this is basically, it's standard operating procedure in any negotiation to put forward demands that go well beyond what you expect to get. And that's what the United States and the P5 plus one were doing in these negotiations, and then backing it up or supporting it with public posturing that made it sound like if Iran didn't agree that these negotiations were going to break down, and it would mean that Iran was not serious about its commitment to a peaceful nuclear program. Now, so that's the contrast on the U.S. and P5 plus one side between the reality on one side and the posturing on the other. But the Iranians were doing this as well. I mean, they knew that the United States was posturing, and they had their own political posturing that primarily was done in the actual drafting text and in the negotiating, but also backed up by some public statements as well. And even in my interview with Zarif, he was saying, well, our objective need is for enough enrichment capability to support the Bushehr reactor. Of course, that would mean
you're speaking of the Iranian negotiator.
Foreign Minister Zarif of Iran was saying that we have to be able to support the Bushehr reactor, and that, of course, would involve many times more centrifuges than they have had in the last few years. So, it's very clear that the Iranians were posturing on that. They inserted in the text language which reflected that demand. And so both sides were making extreme demands, knowing that they would not be able to get them, and as a means of trying to make their later position more acceptable to the other side. And again, this is just a basic operating procedure in any negotiation to be expected to some extent. In this case, however, I think the problem is that the posturing on both sides has been presented as by the news media as the ultimate reality rather than explaining what was really going on. And so I think there's been a massive misapprehension, a misunderstanding on the part of the public that these talks were in serious trouble and that they were very likely to break down in failure. And that's where I come to the Khamenei speech of July 7th. This was part of the posturing. This was an Iranian effort to counter what had just been said a few days earlier by Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman on July 3rd, in which she made another sort of statement saying, the Iranians are simply not doing what is necessary to show that they're serious about their commitment to a peaceful nuclear program. And this was in the context of the United States still, not moving away from its extreme demands, for very large cuts. So Khamenei, supporting his negotiators, put forward this in his speech, this idea that we are definitely going to need 190,000 what he called SWU, that is the equivalent of the enrichment capability of the primitive first generation centrifuges that Iran has deployed. That was treated by the U.S. news media and by U.S. officials as a declaration of extreme demands by Iran, which would doom the talks. And there was another round of sort of official statements and news coverage that made it sound like the talks were on their last legs. But the reality was that this was happening in the context of Zarif and John Kerry planning to meet for two full days to work out a plan to move forward. And so both sides knew this was going to happen. And Zarif went into those talks ready to reassure Kerry that this did not mean that Iran was insisting on 19 times more centrifuges over the next few years, and that in fact this was going to take a longer time, that they were more flexible, and that there was room for negotiating an agreement that that would not require the P5+1 to approve that that objective demand. So that was the essence of the sharp contrast between the political diplomatic reality and the way in which this was presented to the public by the U.S. officials and news media.
Well, you described that absolutely correctly. Reading your article and compared to what I saw in the mainstream media, it was like night and day. My guest is Gareth Porter. I'm going to open the phones in a few minutes, but I have a couple more questions. One, what kind of role do the other countries play in negotiations? I see the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, was seemingly where another country that seems to have its government occupied by Israel was calling for a reduction of several hundred centrifuges.
Indeed, you know, it was clearly that French demand for a few hundred that was actually inserted in the text in brackets. Yes.
The other thing is, what influence or impact do you think the fact that these days, both the United States and Iran, for different interests and for different reasons, are concerned with what is going on in Iraq. Do you think that has had an impact, or were things already moving in such a way that has not had a major impact on finding an agreement in this particular situation?
You know, I think that it's the kind of thing that could have had an impact in the absence of other reasons for moving towards an agreement. In this case, however, I don't think that the events in Iraq have had any real direct impact on the talks. In other words, I think that they were going to take this this route, this direction, and go through these stages in any case. So in the end, Iraq has not really affected the course of the negotiations. But of course, it is going to have an impact, for sure, on the future of U.S.-Iraq relations. U.S.-Iran relations, excuse me.
And now this extension of is for 4 months, correct?
That's right, which takes us into November.
Past the U.S. elections.
That's exactly right, yes.
What impact do you think this will have? Do you think this will become a campaign issue?
It will be a campaign issue to a degree.
And how important do you think the election campaign and the results what impact will have on the final agreement?
I think clearly the Obama administration has a strong incentive to wrap this up well in advance of the election in November. And there's no reason why they cannot do that. In other words, the problems are not such as to require four months. I mean, it can be done in just a couple of sessions in September, and I think they could probably finish by early October, is my guess. And so I think the Obama administration would like, of course, to present the success of the administration in achieving this agreement as one of the things that can be touted by Democrats in the campaign. And on the other side, I mean, there's no doubt that there will be plenty of candidates supported by AIPAC who will try to make this their primary issue and attack the administration for having gone soft on Iran's nuclear threats. So, I mean, that's going to set up, a major issue. I'm not going to say it's going to be the primary issue, but it will be a major issue in a number of contests. And how that's going to go, I'm not an expert on the politics of the congressional election, so I can't give you any reading on that. But it could be that some in some parts of this country that will play, the pro-Israeli position will play well, and some people may well get elected on that basis.
I noticed, as I mentioned earlier, that the neocon think tanks, the Foreign Policy Initiative, which was a successor to PNAC, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was founded by AIPAC, although its director, Patrick Lawson, the other day on C-SPAN said Winnip had no connection to AIPAC, and the Jewish Institute for Near East for National Security Affairs, JINSA, which Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War, are all focusing right now on Iran, forgetting Ukraine, forgetting Iraq, forgetting Gaza. This is their current focus, so I find that very interesting.
Well, of course, it's been the main focus of this set of institutions reflecting Israeli interests for many years, going certainly back to 2004. As soon as the U.S. Had gone into Iraq, it began a process. It triggered the process of the pro-Israeli think tanks beginning to focus entirely on Iran. And you can go back and you can see that by 2004, this whole idea of Iranian breakout, so-called, that was an idea that was put forward by Winnip. They did so in 2004. So, I mean, that to me marks the beginning of this campaign, which is now 10 years old, to try to get the United States to confront Iran, to force Iran to give up its nuclear program.
Well, it's interesting in looking at the list of the who's for, who's against the extension. It's interesting to find that the American Jewish Committee, the oldest Jewish organization in the United States, one of the two oldest ones, which acts as like the foreign policy arm of the Israel lobby, and whose director, David Harris, has spent a lot of time going around the world lobbying for supporting sanctions and whatever is necessary against Iran, even put out ads in the newspapers showing the map of the world and the potential of Iran nuclear weapon hitting everywhere. The American Jewish Committee has come out supporting the extension, saying that a limited extension of the negotiations makes sense, the preferred option to relieve the Middle East and the world of the threat of Iran nuclear capability is a diplomatic one. This is a major step, I think, and shows that there are breaks within this establishment and their dedication to a confrontation with Iran.
I think I'd have a slightly different interpretation of that, and you may know more about it than I do. But I would just guess that there's also a factor here of sort of calculating that in order to strengthen the credibility of the institutions that are really wanting to sabotage the agreement, that they're better off, saying, yes, of course, we support trying to do this, rather than saying, we don't want negotiations. I think maybe that could be a tactic, in other words, a political tactic to strengthen their credibility and be more effective in what they want.
I think you're right. In second thought, I should not have been surprised that they're a smart operation. We do have a call. Let's go to a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My mother and I are both part of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And I think that...
Wilps, yes.
Right.
My mother was a member, too.
Yeah, well, I think that we need to look at the American military as a target and as an integral part of this whole peace process, because here we are, them armed and dangerous, providing money to kill the Gaza Strip is a contained area. I feel like the Palestinian people are like little rats in a cage. They have nowhere to go. There are 600 dead. Excuse me, it's genocide. And the racism, two wrongs don't make a right. And nonviolence is the answer. And I think that until we can confront the military establishment as no longer necessary, no longer a means to an end, we must disarm, nuclear disarmament, starting with here at home. We've got problems right here in our own backyard that we're going to have to deal with. And by putting this sheepskin over the wolf of militarism, hatred, genocide, intolerance. It comes down to respect. And in God's garden, there are many flowers. And well, there are many trees that peacefully coexist. There are many peoples that have continued to peacefully coexist in Jerusalem and in Israel and in Palestine. My brother was here a couple days ago.
My dear, well said. We just have a couple of moments.
The history of Palestine and how it was created. How Israel was created and how they have invaded. These people have a right to exist.
We're coming into the hour, but I want Gareth to be able to
say
that. Thank you. Yes.
I couldn't agree with the caller more. I have a vision that this country must deal with the permanent war state which we have created. It is a grave danger to our freedom. It's a grave danger to our security. It's a grave danger to the viability of this society. And we must do something about this urgently. I agree.
Well, Gareth Porter, I want to thank you very much. We've come down to the end of the hour. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Another very informative discussion. And thank you, caller. And look forward to our next discussion on this issue. And I know there'll be one coming up probably fairly soon. So thanks so much for being our guest again. Takes on the World, Gareth.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Bye-bye.